I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
The new book by David Posen, The Constitution of the War on Drugs, shows how constitutional law could have denied the worst excesses of the war on drugs instead of becoming ever more defined by them, and offers clues about how to resist draconian drug policies today. David Posen is a Charles Keller Beekman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. Posen teaches and writes about constitutional law, information law, and nonprofit law, among other topics. David, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Let's begin. How long did it take you to write the book, and why did you write the book?
I think it took about 2 years. And the main motivation was that I was struck by an absence. The drug reform movement routinely invokes themes like individual liberty, racial equality, rational government decision-making that are at the heart of modern constitutional law, and yet the reformers never seem to invoke the Constitution itself. And I was puzzled by that absence and wanted to figure out, where did the Constitution go, you know, in our drug reform conversations? And I knew enough to know that it had been a big part of prior generations' conversations, and that was what led me into the historical research for the book.
Well, and your history begins in 1910, where authorities were unanimous in maintaining that constitutional provisions protected protected possession. Can you walk us through where this protection is noted in the Constitution and the right. challenges that further solidify this to be known as the law of the land?
Sure. A lot of that was actually happening under state constitutions, which the book also addresses. And it happened in two main ways in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A lot of those cases involved alcohol. And one line of cases said that state constitutions protect the right to the pursuit of happiness, as well as liberty and property, and bans on alcohol that prevented personal possession or consumption violated some of those, something in that bundle of rights, liberty, property, happiness. And then another line of cases held that no level of government, state or federal, has the power to control what happens in a purely private setting. So the manufacture and sale of alcohol might be restricted because that's not purely private, but what you do in your own home, if you brew your own alcohol, drink your own alcohol, the government just doesn't have the regulatory authority to go that far. So under both of those headings, there are actually pretty robust rights for drug use and possession in the late 1800s and early 1900s, which all got wiped away in the middle part of the 20th century.
Let's talk about the 1910s and how the legal framework started to fall apart then. Can you take us through the wave of prohibitory laws that swept the nation?
Sure. Yeah, in that period, you had really the first iteration of the war on drugs, if you will. And legislators across the country started to crack down on not just alcohol, but opium, particularly in the West, cocaine and marijuana started to get regulated too. And there was more and more pressure building to allow the government to restrict these various drugs. And 1915, some historians identify as the key pivot year when courts basically fold and start to say that the right to the pursuit of happiness no longer constrains drug regulation, and the state government's so-called police power that allows them to regulate in the interests of public health, safety, and welfare can reach into the home and prevent not just distribution and manufacture of drugs, but also personal possession and consumption. And so basically by the end of the 1910s, this new wave of prohibitory drug laws is upheld, and the government has much more freedom than it had previously to restrict drugs.
And was there anything in particular that you think led the courts to folding on this issue?
The standard explanation is a kind of a realist one, that just the political pressure outside of the courts built up to a point where they didn't want to be in its way. More generally, I would say the courts were getting increasingly comfortable with the expansion of government power, you know, to regulate, again, in the interest of public health, safety, and welfare, recognizing that in a modern society, in a modern economy, the government would need broad berth to to do that sort of regulation. So some combination of a ideological shift toward respecting a greater role for government and just the wave of, you know, anti-drug laws that they were under pressure to uphold probably are two of the biggest factors.
And then just kind of taking the understanding that things started changing, as you said, about 1915 was the year that seems to be a key pivot point, you know, up through about the, I would say, beginning of the 1960s, the federal government began to have kind of, and federal lawmakers had carte blanche to penalize drug possession and consumption. Is it truly just because of that, you know, greater role of wanting to control drugs? Was there a political party behind this, or was it just, again, kind of the moral standing of the nation at that time?
Yeah, it's a pretty bipartisan story throughout the 20th century as we get more and more punitive drug laws, actually. I mean, in different moments, there are different, you know, protagonists, but it really wasn't so much a partisan story. It was some combination of moralism, you know, American puritanical perfectionism, racism with respect to a number of drugs that were targeted, at genuine good faith concerns about public health in the face of, you know, new products that were seen to be dangerous. So some mix of noble and base motives, you know, drove the drug control project, foreign policy imperatives. Once the pharmaceutical industry gets up and running, they become a big player by the mid-20th century, pushing for restrictions basically on drugs they don't make and, you know, intellectual property and other protections for synthetic drugs they do make. So it's a complicated story, but really cannot be reduced to a partisan one. You have U.S. policy elites pushing stricter and stricter drug controls really throughout the 20th century.
Okay, so it wasn't partisan, and you mentioned that part of what drove it was the American Puritan culture. How did the U.S. lead on this? How was this taking place on the global stage? Were we following other countries? Were we leading? How does that play out in history?
A bit of a combination, but it's often told as a story of our leadership. This really comes fully into place later in the 20th century. There are early international drug control efforts around the turn of the 20th century, but by the post-war period, post-World War II period, the U.S. government is pushing for international drug control treaties. And we get the first breakthrough in 1961 with the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. And then there are two subsequent UN treaties that most of the world's countries have now joined. And the story's a bit complicated. The U.S. wasn't just imposing its will on the world. A number of other countries, for their own domestic reasons, supported strict, you know, controls on drugs too. But certainly the U.S. was playing a huge role in pushing those treaties. And this is a bit beyond the book, but I'll just say I view those treaties as pretty disastrous for people who favor liberal drug reform. They basically commit all states that are parties to them to restrict and blize a very long list of drug behaviors and contribute at a kind of higher level to some of our malaise on drug policy that they're very hard treaties to revise.
The Biden administration and FDA and lawmakers have been taking recent steps to change the zero tolerance policies of the recent past, but you say that there was a similar approach that almost went out 50 years ago. What were the forces that put the question of drug rights back into play in the 1960s and 70s?
Great. Yeah, my book really focuses on that period in the 60s and 70s when the possibility of constitutional protections for drug users came back after it had been vanquished in the early 1900s. The forces that brought that back into the conversation were myriad, but they included, new constituencies for drug reform coming out of students and colleges and college-educated professionals who were increasingly using illicit drugs and the counterculture that followed. Vietnam veterans also were using illicit drugs in large numbers and could not be dismissed as some, you know, radical left-wing movement. And President Nixon has to therefore show some sympathy toward drug addiction in light of its association with the war. And you have establishment groups of all kinds, including the American Bar Association and the American Medical Association, the National Council on Churches, the National Council on Rabbis, all come out in support of decriminalization of marijuana, at least in the late 60s and early 70s. You also have a torrent of medical studies showing that some of the lines that Americans have been fed for years about drugs like marijuana were largely false. And so so it's this period of possibility where all kinds of political actors, elites, and others are open to drug liberalization. And that ends up creating a window of possibility for the courts to come in, and we get this tidal wave of litigation in that period.
Yeah, so it was a window of opportunity for the courts, but the judges were warning about legal chaos if they recognized too many claims of personal liberty or constitutionalized hard calls about the dangerousness of various substances. In your view, why would legal chaos have ensued?
I think that that was overstated, that narrative of chaos. But that is, it's not crazy what some of the judges were saying in being afraid of what they had started. So let me give a few examples to make it clearer. In 1965, the Supreme Court recognizes a new right to privacy under the what would eventually be under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And that case involved the right of a married couple to use contraception in the home, Griswold versus Connecticut. But drug lawyers, among others, quickly realized that, oh, if adults have a right to privacy in the home with regard to behaviors that don't have an immediate harm to others, then that looks like it might protect drugs. And so they start litigating the right to privacy argument. And there, judges basically get worried that everyone's going to come in here with their new privacy or liberty argument, and we need to really close the floodgates some, or else we're going to be endlessly resolving these politically and socially sensitive disputes. Lots of cases in that period also involved the right to wear your hair long, you know, in a government institution that forbade that, or to ride a motorcycle without a helmet. And so some of what you see, I think, is just not wanting to have to resolve an endless stream of personal liberty claims. So basically what judges do is they develop a new test that says, if you want to make a liberty or privacy argument, you have to first convince the court that it's a fundamental liberty or privacy interest that's being abridged. And only then will we basically give you serious review. And that threshold question of, you know, whether you have a fundamental right at stake or not ends up being fatal to drug rights claims. Because while judges are willing to recognize that there's some, you know, personal autonomy, privacy, interest in drug use, they're not willing to say that it's a fundamental right. So that's one example. But more generally, I think judges wanted to prevent a situation where they became the chief regulators of drug policy. And so they, after initially being open to these drug claims and recognizing at some level that our drug laws had become counterproductive and draconian, by the end of the 1970s, the story I tell is of them pulling back.
And, you know, there was a period in time where people pull back, and you've mentioned how constitutional rights have been designed to respond to claims of mistreatment brought by like discrete and insular minorities who share reasonably cohesive social identity. So showing like gay rights movement and guns rights movement, you know, you've got people out there marching for this right, but you really don't see illicit drug users pull together and, you know, go for change. And that's kind of a unique piece with regards to drug use and your right as an American citizen.
Yeah, great. What I talk about there is how there have been a few famously successful rights movements in the late 20th century, early 21st century American constitutional law. Gay rights, gun rights are often people's key examples. And what some legal scholars have written about is that the kinds of rights movements that seem to succeed involve what the Supreme Court calls discrete and insular minorities. These are groups that share this reasonably cohesive social identity that recognize each other and are able to organize together effectively with kind of identitarian claims about who they are and why they deserve equal treatment. And that doesn't characterize the drug movement. The drug movement is huge in the sense that tens of millions of Americans are using illegal drugs every year and therefore subjecting themselves to possible prison time. So it's a bit of a puzzle. Like, why doesn't that group of people come together to fight these policies that could harm them? And whereas the gay rights and gun rights movements are starting from a very weak legal position in the 1960s, very little case law on their side, the drug rights reformers actually have quite a bit of case law that they can work with. And so there I tell a story about basically the social movement doesn't come together. Drug rights, people who might have supported drug rights basically remain in the closet, don't come out as drug users and find each other, and are unwilling to make kind of affirmative arguments about what's good or attractive about their lifestyle. All the arguments they muster are negative in character, like the government is overreaching, it's being heavy-handed. But they don't make a case about why certain kinds of drug use, presumably not all, but certain kinds, can be positive, pro-social, something they're meaningful to identities rather than just a tolerable vice.
And probably the drug that Americans have unified around and become more accepting of, is, as far as state law, is marijuana. And just last week, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration moved to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. Does this declassification automatically ease any restrictions of significance?
My view on that is that it's welcome and overdue, but going to be much less consequential than people may hope or expect. So basically what happened there is, with a big nudge from President Biden, the Justice Department just announced that it is recommending marijuana move from the most restrictive drug schedule in the federal law, Schedule 1, down to Schedule 3. And some people think, and so that is likely to happen in the coming months, that recommendation will be approved. And some people think that will give us medical marijuana at the federal level, because drugs in Schedule 3 can be prescribed by physicians. But the hitch is that they can only be prescribed if they've been approved by the FDA as well. And marijuana has not been approved by the FDA and is unlikely to be approved anytime soon. So it's not actually going to be the case. So we get medical marijuana at the federal level, and we'll still have this inconsistent, you know, patchwork of laws on marijuana at the federal and state levels. There's one concrete thing that the reform actually will do, which will be useful for marijuana companies in states that have licensed them, which is, there's a provision of the Internal Revenue Code, the tax code, that says that companies that traffic in Schedule 1 or 2 drugs can't get an ordinary business deduction. So when marijuana is moved to Schedule 3, that provision will no longer apply, and basically marijuana companies will get a tax break. So that's good, you know, for the industry, and if you want it to grow, that's not nothing, that's meaningful. But it's not necessarily going to change Americans' daily experience of marijuana's availability anywhere.
Does my limited knowledge of this, if I'm not mistaken, being Schedule 3 means that, like, universities cannot do research on the effects and the harm of marijuana. Am I correct that by moving it down to Schedule 2, now we could do research and actually find out how addictive it is, what are the pros, what are the cons?
It may liberate some more research, but actually, even with Schedule 1 drugs, where marijuana has been ever since 1970, research can be approved by the government, you know, on a special basis, and that has allowed a lot of marijuana research to happen, in some sense potentiating this change that is about to occur, because there's a large body of evidence now about marijuana's potential medical benefits and risks. But I'm more research should be done, and the move to Schedule 3 may help, but we're actually fairly far along on that at this point. And there's also a lot of research that's been done abroad.
As we come close to concluding the interview, I want to have you talk a little bit about, you know, now that evidence-based drug reform is on the table, you state that proponents would do well to entrench as much of it in constitutional law as they can before the next panic arrives. How can policymakers protect against future backsliding?
Great. I end up saying toward the end of the book that all the old arguments, constitutional arguments made against punitive drug laws, a lot of them are foreclosed for the foreseeable future, because the you know, the case law went against them. And that includes privacy and liberty arguments and equal protection arguments about race and rationality, Eighth Amendment arguments against cruel and unusual punishment. But notwithstanding that there's all this unfavorable precedent on some of those grounds, there are actually still a lot of constitutional moves that still might be made. For example, originalism has become very fashionable at the Supreme Court, that is, interpreting the Constitution's phrases in accordance with what they meant to people at the time they were written and ratified. And I basically canvassed the originalism literature and maybe surprisingly show that you can challenge punitive drug laws on originalist grounds a number of ways. You know, for example, the leading historical scholarship on what people meant in 1791 when they wrote in the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, it's quite an expansive understanding of that prohibition, which may well rule out long prison sentences for nonviolent drug crimes of all kinds. So I think a faithful originalist could easily get to a much more humane drug policy under the Eighth Amendment. And there are also a whole range of constitutional techniques used by courts abroad, because constitutional courts in Latin America, Europe, and elsewhere have increasingly recognized personal rights to possession and consumption of soft drugs, physically non-addictive drugs. And they use a different style of review that basically weighs costs and benefits. And I also suggest that state Supreme Courts, which have shown more interest than our federal courts in that style of review, could learn from courts abroad. So it won't be easy, but I would say there's still a number of constitutional moves open to drug reformers that could, they can't get us to an enlightened and effective drug policy on their own, but they can at least stave off some of the most extreme examples of overpunishment.
And before we let you go, I have to ask, I was fortunate enough a few years ago to be able to do some travel. And so I've seen different cultures' impact on their drug laws. And so I'm going to give you three locations. You choose one. So the first one is Singapore, and what the legal structure there, maybe what we can learn from that, if there's any pros from that. Or the Netherlands, which is very open. Singapore is the death penalty for drug possession. Netherlands being the opposite extreme. And then here in the U.S., Portland. So pick one in a minute or less. Give us your thoughts on the legal things that we can learn from that.
I guess I'll take Portland just because it's been so in the news of late and say I worry that people may be learning the wrong lessons from what happened there. Portland tried a robust form of decriminalization, but wasn't very effective at pairing that with positive social supports for people who lack housing, who lack health care, who have mental health problems, who lack stable employment. And one big lesson I take from Portland is it is a fantasy to think that liberalizing drug laws in itself will do a great deal of good. You really need to also provide infrastructure for people to get what they need from the government. And so I guess I worry that another panic may set in soon following what happened in Oregon, in which people think that decriminalization means all kinds of new, more dangerous pathological drug behaviors. I think the deeper lesson is that decriminalization has to be paired with a broader, you know, strategy for combating some of the deeper drivers of the problems in Oregon, like lack of affordable housing.
Well, we've had this opportunity to speak with David Posen about his new book, The Constitution on the War on Drugs. David, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me on.
On April 20th of this year, the people of the Canary Islands came out in force to protest tourism. Zach Garner Perkis, the investigations editor at the UK Daily Express, joined the 120,000 protesters that day and is with us this morning to help us understand what the locals were fighting for. Zach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I need to paint a picture for the audience. Canary Islands off the northwest coast of the African continent, but actually the islands are ruled by Spanish law, are part of Spain. And I think of this as primarily Tenerife, one of the Canary Islands, primarily tourism, almost like Park City in many ways. So can you give our listeners a sense of what are the main economic drivers in the Canary Islands?
Well, I mean, so it is, it's overwhelmingly a tourist destination. It's kind of the spot where Europeans, particularly Northern Europeans, so Brits, Germans, people from Norway, Sweden, they tend to go and get their winter sun. And you know, the tourist industry has flourished. They've got some great beaches. Yeah, like I say, terrific weather. And yeah, I mean, really, that is what dominates the economy. There's a bit of public sector, and traditionally it was kind of a, you know, farming and agriculture, but that's just been, you know, the last kind of 30, 40 years, tourism has just taken over, and that is the dominant force.
So, you know, we're here talking to you today about a protest on April 20th, but no doubt their tension has been building for a while. Can you talk about how long the tension against tourism has been building up on the Canary Islands?
Well, I would say it's a bit more of a complex picture than just being kind of, you know, that people are, the protesters were quite clear that they weren't anti-tourist, because everyone in the Canaries, which is the kind of group of islands, you know, Tenerife is the main island, they'll all know someone or will be benefiting directly from tourism. I think, though, what happened was post-COVID, the cost of living and cost of housing has escalated to such an extent that it's really, really difficult, especially for the young people, to kind of access some of the basic things that their older relatives might have been able to. And when that kind of happened, it's just built up. So kind of since everyone was kind of delighted of the tourists coming back in kind of 2021, it's kind of the pressures that have been on the local people have really built like then. So, I mean, I guess there was a bit of resentment before, but it's really been kind of the last 2 to 3 years that this has built up to the extent where you've got these giant protests.
Yeah, it's a story around the world, right? And I think possibly one of the things with the Canary Islands is, unlike our town, which is also a tourist town, it's kind of a la carte here in our town, right? You stay at a hotel, you spend money at the ski resort, you go to a restaurant. And my impression of Tenerife and the Canary Islands is a lot of those are all-inclusive. You go and you're spending all of your money at the resort. Do you think that played a role as well, where tourists aren't spending money broadly but in a very focused way?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and that ties into the economic pressures that you're seeing in other parts of Europe, because people are going all-inclusive because the point is they just spend their money before they go. You know, they step off the plane, they go into a resort, and they're eating and drinking, and it's all covered. You know, a lot of the times they don't step outside. So yeah, that definitely means the kind of trickle down money that you normally would get, where even sometimes when people were staying all inclusive, they'd pop out for a meal or maybe a couple of drinks in the evening. That just isn't happening in the way that it used to, which, yeah, that definitely puts a lot more pressure on those kind of businesses that are at the side, because, you know, it's the big hotel chains that are kind of dominate the resorts. And then I think, as you say, in America, the mom and pop stores, you know, they're suffering. And then that's kind of what brings people out in the streets.
Now, when people were protesting on April 20th, you know, you had mentioned in your article that they were not telling tourists to go home. What were they saying? What were they protesting exactly?
Well, I think it's kind of a complicated one, because a lot of the banners that they were holding up were saying, "Your tourism kills our island." And I'd go up to the people and say, you know, "Is this what you think?" And they'd say, no, we're not anti-tourists. What we want are limits on tourism. And kind of when you dug into a little bit more about what they were really feeling, this is to do with kind of access to housing, you know, home ownership, second homes. You've got a lot of retired people in the UK, Germany, the Nordics, that are taking their big retirement pots and going and buying a bit of all year round sun. And, you know, that then pushes out the locals. And those are the kind of things that they're really frustrated about. They don't want people to stop coming and enjoying it, but it's doing it in a way that's kind of sustainable and that they can benefit from.
You know, that's a really good point, because as an American, if I wanted to retire in the Canary Islands, that's a huge a long path I have to go down. I imagine I'd have to get EU citizenship first somewhere if I wanted to actually retire and live there full time. But for somebody that's part of the EU, it's just as simple as saying I want to retire there, even though the economic situation for somebody from Germany is very different than for somebody that was raised on the Canary Islands. So the protesters had these issues they were complaining about. Was there a group that was offering solutions and saying, this is bad, this would be better?
I mean, actually, just an interesting one to kind of pick up on one of the points that you're making there, which is what brought home to me how extreme the situation in the Canaries is, was I found a community of people who were living in tents in a ravine, and there, within them, there were a group of Hungarians who, one of whom was a pensioner, who was living in a tent because he preferred to live in a tent in the Canaries and kind of saved by a camper van there than living in the freezing cold of Hungary in kind of March, April time. So, you know, that definitely shows, and that, you know, he's using resources, damaging the environment, all sorts of things that the local people are really unhappy about. In terms of the solutions, that what they want to do is put in a tourist tax and kind of try and just redirect the money that is going in. I mean, they also have issues to do with kind of localized corruption. There are hotels being built illegally, so hotels that don't have the proper permits, that just they're just built and kind of then worry about the legalities of it afterwards. So it's stopping that, you know, that's the starting point. And then it's a case of, you know, what tourist tax, how can they raise some money from tourism that they can then redirect in investing into other sectors so they're not so reliant on tourism and that it can be done in a sustainable way?
You know, you're talking about, you know, how important and how dire many people feel the situation is. I think the number of people protesting on April 20th came close to 120,000. There's also a hunger strike that was launched. You know, what are the status of these other forms of defiance, you know, all underneath the same banner of anti-tourism?
So with the hunger strikers, what they've done is that they've not made public the names of the people that are on hunger strike. My understanding is that they were in quite a serious condition, but they weren't gathering very much interest from the people that they were trying to, which are the powers that be in the Canaries. That the hunger strikers, it's quite startling. I went down to the town where the tents are set up, and it's the atmosphere is it's quite, I'd say, mournful. Like, you know, it's a very serious thing that they're doing, and that they're, you know, and you know, hunger strike is the most extreme method that you can use. It's a little bit of a mystery in terms of exactly what the status they are, because like I say, you just get bits of information rather than being able to speak to the hunger strikers directly. But they're not in the best condition. I don't know how much longer it can continue on for.
And then you had mentioned again, you know, they're trying to grab attention, and the hunger strikers maybe weren't grabbing the attention they needed. Whose attention are they trying to grab? When you talk about local regulations, is it just local government in the Canary Islands, or are we talking all the way back to Spain?
I think it's a bit of both. The interesting thing with this is that it was through the interest of international media that things started to move in the Canaries and in Spain. I mean, Spain has a kind of federalist system that is a little bit similar to the US, but I would say kind of a bit more, you know, it's a bit close, you know, a bit more European. And they are trying, it's lawmakers in Spain, but locally there is a lot of frustration at the way that things have been run, where it's just money talks, and there is a perception locally that there has been a lot of corruption which has led to this situation. So I think it is quite localized, but also obviously they feel neglected by Spain because, I mean, for obvious reasons, these are a group of small islands very far away, don't tend to get the attention that they perhaps feel they deserve.
Yeah, at least here in the United States, a tourist tax is one of the easiest taxes to pass because it's something that other people pay, right? So increasing your hotel tax, increasing rental car tax, and I actually had a flight booked to the Canary Islands when I was in Spain. It was either Barcelona or Madrid to Tenerife. And it was like $29 each way. And it's like a 4 or 5 hour flight. It's a long flight. So what impact do you think this low-cost airlines are playing in the challenge that these 120,000 people are protesting against?
I mean, that's just part of... It's the reason that those costs are so low is because that, you know, they can put the... they can fill the planes with people. Like, it's... I guess it's a factor there, but it's... The economy has become so weighted that they need to have sufficient numbers to fill out those big hotels. And this is kind of, I guess you get into the root of the issue here, which is like, once you've built an economy that is so reliant on tourism that you need to have such large numbers of people, how do you then evolve away from that to something that is more sustainable rather than you're building bigger hotels and you're expanding? Because, you know, that's the way that the model works.
No, absolutely. As knowing that these protests aren't concluded, how do you plan on kind of keeping a thumb on the pulse of what's going on there?
I mean, so I'm still in contact with, you know, the people that were organizing this. There's huge interest in this, not just in the UK, but in Germany and these other places where there are, I mean, a lot of British and German people that live in Tenerife. I mean, I went round the bars and there's Scottish bars, there's Irish bars, and that, you know, these are people that have spent kind of 10, 15 years there. So, I'll be keeping a close eye on it. I guess it's how things develop. Like, what are the measures that they bring in? If they don't come in, is there going to be more unrest? I don't think this is an issue, a topic that's going to go away at all. It's probably going to become more extreme, especially if we get more economic shockwaves that kind of drive up the cost of living and affect the way that people holiday in Spain.
So we're kind of sister locations with a place like the Canary Islands, because we are tourist-based. And when the locals make a stink here in Park City, we hear about it right away. And then we oftentimes get a political response to it within weeks. The local politicians will say, here's what we're thinking on that issue. For instance, in the holiday periods, we had something. If you use the word Carmageddon, to any local here in Park City, we instantly know what that is, which is just the traffic congestion that we see. Mm-hmm. And when that came up, within days, we had the local politicians responding and saying, here's our thoughts on that. What are the local politicians in Tenerife saying?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one, because one of the big messages that's been coming back from the local politicians is kind of, well, look, we're still open for business. We still want you to come. The other side of this dynamic with the protests are the, I guess it's, they, a lot of them would see themselves as a kind of silent majority who are like, we love tourism. We want tourism. It's an amazing thing. And I think that the response from the politicians so far has been to play to that audience as opposed to the protesters so much, which, I think it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it develops. The proposals about the tourist tax have developed, but I still think that there's that kind of sense of they don't want to scare people away.
Okay. Well, good luck. Good luck to them. 120,000 people. That's quite the protest. That's quite the size of things. Zach, before I let you go, just quickly, when you made the decision to cover that protest, did you have a sense it was going to be that large?
No. That's a short answer.
What is the population of Tenerife?
I was in close contact with one of the organizers who was very optimistic, but that just blew everything out of the water. It was completely unprecedented.
Is that half the population of Tenerife? Is it 10%? What's the population there?
It's about 10% of the island of Tenerife. So, yeah, that's, you know, hugely significant.
Very, very much so. Well, we've been speaking with Zach Garner Perkis. It's a fascinating story. Like I said, we have some parallels here in Park City. Zach, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
The St. Regis Deer Valley offers exceptional dining options with cuisine as exquisite as its views. Joining us this morning to discuss how their dining provides experiences beyond the imagination is Chef Lawrence Abrams and Executive Sous Chef Jason Larman. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Okay, so anytime I get invited to a dinner at the St. Regis, the answer is always yes, and then I figure out if I have to move some things around the calendar. So give our audience an idea of what the traditional main dishes are and then what maybe some new things coming out are.
I would say like some of our classics here at St. Regis are going to be obviously our oysters, shrimp cocktail, things of those nature. Wagyu carpaccio has been around for years and years and years. And then as we start to rotate and get into the new ideas of what we're trying to bring to the St. Regis, it becomes more seasonality. So it's more about using the terroir behind our backyard and the terroir that we have here in Park City and in the valley, and using those ingredients that you can find right out of your backyard and putting those on the plate. So I equate it to, as the elk is roaming and eating the grass and picking the nuts off of the trees, what would be more complimentary on the dish than to serve the items that he actually feeds off of?
You just used a term I'm not familiar with. Terroir?
Terroir. Terroir is the French fancy word for land, for the mineral values of the land. So as you look into wine produced productions and stuff like that, they talk about terroir, which is basically the essence of the rolling valleys, or if it's laced with minerals, or if there's high concentration of chlorine or whatever it may be. It's just all based off the terroir. And one of the one things that I've noticed here in town with chefs is that we're not using the resources of our terroir to our ability with the vast variety of options that we have here in the valley.
So I'm going to step back just a little bit in starting with, tell us a little bit about how long St. Regis has been in town and how many dining restaurants you have, because it's not just one. Mm-hmm. You've got quite a few.
I'm going to pass this one on to Jason since he's been there a little longer than
All
I
right.
have.
All right, Jason, tell us about it.
So St. Regis has been around since 2009. We have, I think, four outlets right now. We do have some pop-ups going on with the terrace, the pool, also the vintage room in the winter. Right now, main floor is the third floor with Rhyme Brasserie 7452, which basically is a French-inspired gastro pub.
Very nice.
So,
and I have a friend that was a sous, Jason, you're a sous chef, you're the executive sous chef.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend that was a sous chef for better part of a decade, and he told me that was the hardest job in the kitchen. You know, he's just constantly trying to make it to the head chef. Do you agree with them, and what makes it one of the harder jobs?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the harder jobs. You're overseeing everything, and you're being the liaison between the upper echelon of chefs and food and beverage directors, and then you're also delegating downwards to the CDCs and the other junior sous, the tournaments, so on and so forth. So there's a lot of paperwork and processing and just walking around all day and just helping out wherever you need to see a spot that needs to be filled, you fill it. So it's quite a journey, but it's fun. I enjoy it.
And for me, when I think about restaurants and I think about a chef, I think one restaurant has a chef. And so when I look at St. Regis Deer Valley, I see Chef Matthew Harris, and then I see Chef Lawrence Abrams and more. How does it work where it's one, you know, lodging property? Is it different chefs? Are there different staffs? Do you all work together?
So it's all one big conglomeration. So Chef Matt Harris, he's the consulting chef. And then you have the executive chef, Pearson Shields, then myself, then Larry Abrams. You have a banquet chef, Daniel Ruiz. And then you start getting into the sous chefs and everybody underneath. So it's all about communication constantly, especially with that many moving parts. If we're not communicating, then the squeaky wheels get a lot louder. So, yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned Chef Matt Harris, because my next question here is about Matt. And he's also included in the Rhyme Seafood and Steak restaurant. Is it common to have a chef involved in more than one dining establishment within a hotel?
Yeah, for the most part, with hotels, there's a lot of third parties that go on. So sometimes there'll be some celebrity chefs like, you know, Jean-Georges, Richard Sandoval, Gordon Ramsay, stuff like that, that'll come into a hotel, bring in concepts, get the ball rolling, and then there's a team that comes in behind them that keeps it going. So
for example, with that being said, Matt Harris, myself, Jason, and Pearson, we collaborate once to twice a month about the direction of where the menu needs to go. And then they put it into my lap to go ahead and create the dishes and be innovative in that sense, to where I get to kind of flex my culinary prowess and my brain and squeak my brain out and come up with these new concepts of ideas that we've collaborated with together to bring the restaurant to the next level, and then continue to push the envelope every day. Every day I always say, yesterday was yesterday, today's going to be a better day, and then trying to reach that pinnacle.
And that's, what I like about this section of the show is that it's messages that anyone can relate to whether or not they're a chef, and mm-hmm. I think that's a great statement. One thing, you talked about keeping the menu up to date with what's happening on kind of the earth surrounding mm-hmm. the property. Talk to me about the different summer seasons and how you look to activate. I heard pop-ups with terrace and mm-hmm. pool and things like that. How do you start to blend that information in as well?
So it's a big moving, like Ferris wheel, as he said. It's just this big cranking wheel that every day we're kind of looking at and see which part of the Ferris wheel can we like mix or minute or change or put on new passengers and move. With the ever-changing weather here in Park City, this is my first adventure in a town like this, so for me it's kind of different. I come from the ocean, so it's really stagnant. It's 80 degrees all year round, and you don't have to worry about it. But with this ever-changing cycle of weather, it's very critical that you look at what the opportunities are with your local farmers. So we use 4 or 5 local farmers within the area, from Heber down to Salt Lake City, and they produce specific items just for us based on what we're thinking about putting on the menu. And so we're matching flavors 3 months in advance, so that we know as they plant, 3 months from now, we know what we have to work with going into the end of the summer, let's call it end of summer into fall. So we're talking with them now saying, hey, we're looking forward to doing this in October. Will you be ready? Yes, I'll start planting now. So for summer, we've already bypassed that wow. kind of that conversation. Yeah. So we're ahead of the game. So now he's already got all our product ready for us now to roll out for the summer. So it's kind of that, I'm a firm believer of if you grab the community and you involve them in what you're doing, then the community as a whole gets greater. No one kind of feels left out, and it's kind of involving, and we're such a small, tight-knit community here in Park City that the more we can get involved with our local resources and our local farmers, it kind of accentuates the idea of how big Park City is.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned you're new to town.
Yeah.
From an ocean location. Yeah. So I'm glad that you've picked up on that so closely. I think one of the things that makes Park City so unique is this tight community. And listening to both of you speak, I can hear the passion in your voice for what you do. This is a question for both of you. What are you most passionate about in your job? What's the part of your job that makes you most excited?
You want me to go first? What makes me more excited about my job is the fact that I get every day is a new day. There's nothing that's ever the same. Every day I wake up, there's going to be a new challenge. There's going to be a new exception to the rule. But for me, the most exciting thing about my job, and I've been doing it for almost 30 years now, is that when I see a guest leave my dining room content and full, that means that I was successful. I don't need a tip, I don't need a letter, I don't need it. Just the smile on the face and the reassurance that they had one of the best experiences of their time makes me feel that I was successful in that day. There's always gonna be a hiccup, something's always gonna catch on fire, you're gonna burn something, it's just part of the deal. But when you see that guest leave the facility with full contentment, that means that I was successful, and then I can go put my head on my pillow and rest at night.
Jason. How would you like to answer that?
You pretty much said it all in a nutshell. For me, it's, I've been doing it just as long as Larry. So my end is more the mentorship. Like, I enjoy seeing who has the passion, who wants to have that drive to become a chef. And it's my job to recognize that, pull them underneath our wings, and start that journey. Because at the end of the day, all chef role is a mentorship. It's all about teaching, showing, growing, nurturing. It's just like having a little child and watching them grow up, and then you kick them out of the nest and like, okay, time to fly. So that's the exciting part of my end. I also enjoy the different aspects of a hotel, of the outlets and all this, the wheels and all that stuff. So
And while we're coming close to wrapping up, can you let our listeners know how they can find out more about what's happening at St. Regis Deer Valley for dining this summer?
So if you go to our website, obviously St. Regis Deer Valley, on our hotel website, you'll find out a lot. But we'll share some ideas with you right now. So we have a local special going on that just started at the beginning of May. Every Tuesday, it's a burger and a beer for $25. Every Wednesday, you show your local ID, you get 20% off your whole bill. Every Thursday, we have no corkage fee. So at any of our dining facilities, you can bring in up to 3 bottles of wine for no corkage fee. Those are some of the cool things that we're doing for our locals. As the city of Main Street kind of pipes down and closes, we're going to offer that for them. Also, starting Father's Day, jazz brunch, and then every Sunday after that. So we'll have live music, jazz, whether DJ or live band.
Okay, well, lots for us to look forward to. We've been fortunate. We've been speaking with Chef Lawrence Abrams and Chef Jason Larimer. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. Thank you for listening to Mound Money. Please leave a review on your podcast app. It would be helpful for us.